honors the head of the House Intelligence Committee, claiming that you're selling documents around the world, which is the language of espionage, calling you a thief, and lots of other political and media elites, from Alan Dershowitz to David Gregory and others, saying that you're a criminal and ought to be arrested. Of course, you have to take those concerns very seriously. At the same time, you know, I absolutely refuse to be exiled from my own country for the crime of doing journalism. And I'm going to force the issue just on principle. And I think coming back for a ceremony like the Polk Award or other forms of journalistic awards would be a really good symbolic test to put the government in the position of having to arrest journalists who are coming back to the U.S. to receive awards for the journalism they've done.
That was journalist Glenn Greenwald. He won a prestigious award today for reporting on documents from NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. He and colleague Laura Poitras entered the U.S. to receive the award despite threats from the U.S. government.
Safety Net of Oregon, an organization that helps the disabled manage their federal benefits, has closed its doors as of April 1st of this year. The Federal Social Security Administration has charged that the nonprofit mismanaged client funds and can't document what happened to over $600,000. No one at Safety Net of Oregon has been charged with a crime. Safety Net of Oregon is the state's largest federal payee with over 1,000 clients. On March 6, the organization was served with federal papers and ordered to shut down. The Social Security Administration then sent out a letter to all clients of Safety Net of Oregon informing individuals to seek new representation. Many advocates for the disabled and homeless populations have strongly criticized the Social Security Agency's response to the closing of Safety Net of Oregon. They claim the notification has led to confusion and to people not getting the money they depend upon for monthly bills and food. Monoma County Chair Marisa Madrigal has contacted the Oregon Congressional Delegation and asked for help in contacting enrollees and helping them find new representation. Multiple advocates of the disabled and homeless have filed a lawsuit in federal court against the Social Security Administration for violating federal statute ensuring clients receive their monthly benefits. In addition, these nonprofit organizations state that Social Security Administration did not notify them of the potential problems nor coordinate any response to the obvious problems that would arise from closing the state's largest organization helping the disabled receive their federal benefits. Corey Burgess, the regional manager of the Social Security Administration, responded with nonchalance and stated the enrollees would show up eventually when they realized their benefits were not available. Most former clients of the Safety Net of Oregon have found a new organization to represent them, but over 130 former enrollees have not yet been notified.
A state government task force will look at genetically modified crops and seeds just 6 months after Oregon barred cities and counties from regulating GMOs. The Genetically Engineered Agriculture Task Force, which will be appointed by Governor John Kitzhaber, is not expected to reach consensus or recommend legislation. The task force will instead, quote, identify and frame the major issues between growers of GMOs and other producers, unquote. And they'll map out when and where genetically engineered crops are grown and develop a plan for buffers and exclusion zones. The task force was promised in a grand bargain in last fall's special legislative session as part of a tax and school funding package that also contained a bill barring local governments from regulating GMOs. That move infuriated many organic farmers. Despite the state ban on regulating GMOs, two county-level ballot measures will appear on the May 20th ballot that propose to ban genetically engineered crops. A collection of GMO manufacturers led by Monsanto has poured more than $800,000 into Oregon to oppose the two measures in Jackson and Josephine counties.
A survey of Oregon State University's 2,771 non-tenure-track faculty presented on Thursday at the OSU Student Union suggests they are overworked, underpaid, and deserve better treatment. conducted by the Oregon State Chapter of the American Association of University Professors, the survey reports that OSU fixed-term faculty have none of the job security of tenured professors, often earning far less money. Instructors typically earn the same salary they were hired at, no matter how many years of service they have put in. Some operate without offices or computers. 68% of OSU faculty are adjuncts. The presentation follows the recent contract settlement at Portland State University, where the PSU AAUP faculty secured 2- and 3-year contracts for 80% of fixed-term faculty. The PSU settlement also lowered the qualifying threshold for multi-year contracts from 6 years to 4 years of service. Oregon State's fixed-term faculty overwhelmingly hold 1-year contracts, and many of them have worked at OSU for 5 years or longer. Quote, like much of the rest of the American economy, American universities have come to rely on a large proof of cheap migrant labor, end of quote, said philosophy professor Jose Antonio Orozco of AAUP OSU. And like Portland State AAUP OSU does not engage in collective bargaining, but serves as a professional advocacy organization. The OSU study found more than half of their non-tenure track instructors make less than $40,000 per year. The Portland State settlement lifted all PSU AAUP faculty to a new minimum salary of $40,000. OSU is considering moves toward multi-year contract and just announced an additional $750,000 in compensation for non-tenure tracks instructors.
The Medford School District is back at the bargaining table, this time negotiating with the non-teaching classified employees. Less than a month ago, the school district settled a contract negotiation with the local teachers union after an 11-day strike. The negotiations made steady progress Thursday, said school superintendent Phil Long. The librarians, secretaries, educational assistants, maintenance workers, and technology workers are represented by Chapter 15 of the Oregon School Employees Association. Their 2-year contract expires June 30. The classified staff made a lot of changes in the 2012 bargaining session, so the scope of the discussion is much narrower, said Superintendent Long. It makes for a much more direct negotiation. The classified employees will likely negotiate over the district's phase-out of early retirement, the employee's 6% contribution to the public employee's retirement system, and caps on the employee's health insurance benefits. These three issues were sticking points in the just-concluded negotiation with the teachers.
As part of Public Health Week, a lunchtime meeting was held yesterday in Northeast Portland to discuss the health impacts of diesel fumes and soot in Portland. A panel of representatives from county agencies gave presentations and then answered questions from the audience. KBOO's David Lang brings us these highlights from the meeting.
So particulate matter is a known carcinogen. It's found in the kind of the Portland region's airshed at pretty unhealthy levels. Last year, there was a study published in the Journal of Atmospheric Environment that quantified premature deaths from air pollution, and it found that in Oregon, PM2.5 contributes to about 1,900 premature deaths every year, and burning diesel fuel is a pretty significant source of particulate matter 2.5 in our environment.
So I want to talk briefly about who suffers the most. So we've already talked about people with chronic disease, right? So anyone with fragile lungs or fragile heart to begin with is going to be very sensitive to this kind of air pollution.
Diesel is part of this cumulative impact on communities and this cumulative burden that are faced. So when we talk to people in public health about social determinants of health, you know, talking about diesel air quality is just one part of that story around all the other kind of burdens that people are facing, whether it's housing, education, criminal justice, you know, the impacts of racism, oppression, lack of power, voice and decision making, etc. So, you know, even though today we're really narrowly kind of focusing on diesel and air quality, we have to recognize that diesel is part of a broader discussion around the various things that exacerbate negative health outcomes.
About, 95% of the trucks are powered by diesel engines. If we were to eliminate diesel engines tomorrow, we'd still have cancer, we still have heart disease, we still have autism, because it's not the single driver for any one of these things, but it's a significant contributor. In fact, from my perspective, it's the one-stop shopping for public health in terms of what you want to do in one fell swoop to clean things up. But here's a bonus one as well, and it's climate change. Now, diesel engines are often touted for climate change because they're actually, because of their efficiency, they had more work done while emitting less CO2 than any other engine platform that's out there. That's great, but for the fact that about 70% of that particulate emissions is of a form they call black carbon, which researchers have recently, last year, identified as probably the second largest human influence of climate change. Now, black carbon on a global scale comes from burning coal, from burning wood, and major sources are in undeveloped countries for people making cook fires to eat their food that they're going to be eating. But in North America, the largest source of black carbon emissions from a climate change perspective is, in fact, the diesel engine. The estimates that I've been looking at for the annual health cost exposure to diesel in Oregon is somewhere between $1.6 and $2 billion a year.
Here in Portland, we've got two rivers here. We've got what's it going, freighters right. Coming in, picking up cargo, etc. We've got barge traffic. We've got interstate traffic.
ODOT has, in their state transportation plan, developed this nice map, for me anyway, in which they show the state of Oregon and they show the major freight routes. And the freight routes are, they drew the freight routes based on a proportion of the freight traffic on those routes. And the thing that's compelling for me about that is they all come to Portland.
Those were speakers at the Multnomah County meeting on the issues of pollution in the city of Portland. The speakers you heard were Matt Davis of Multnomah County Environmental Health, Dr. Jennifer Vines of the County Health Department, Kevin Downing of Department of Environmental Quality.
The World Resources Institute published a report this week critical of the World Bank. The report found that over three-quarters of the projects funded by the World Bank over the last 2 years did not take climate change into account. One of the authors of the report, Designed for the Future, spoke with Robin Ryan about the key findings and recommendations of the report.
I'm talking with Malat Patel, and he is a research analyst in sustainable finance with the World Resources Institute and one of the authors of a report called Designed for the Future. Projects that the World Bank has chosen to fund during the six fiscal quarters covering all of 2012 and the first half of 2013. The findings of this report, though, suggest that climate change failed to make the list of factors to consider 75% of the time. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Does that seem to coalesce with the messaging that we recently heard from the president of the World Bank in, with regard to addressing climate change?
Just a quick background, the projects that we looked at were in the first couple months of the new World Bank president, but also overlapped with some of the previous World Bank president. So we recognize that there's some of the things that the new World Bank president, Jim Yong Kim, has prioritized as climate change being a major focus of the institution. They may not have necessarily showed up in the projects that we looked at, but no, certainly it's a surprise for an organization which is aimed at ending extreme poverty. And, you know, for us, you can't address extreme poverty around the world without addressing climate change.
Can you talk about the terms and the conditions of the funding? What will it cost ultimately the communities where these projects go on? Are these loans? Do they have to be paid back?
Some of the projects that we looked at were provided as loans through the World Bank's arm that works with primarily middle-income countries. Some are a blend of resources, including grants and other sort of concessional finance. But I think in terms of communities, what's the major impact is the infrastructure and facilities that are built for them through these projects sometimes don't take into account all of the risks that, you know, really are going to be major and prominent according to climate change projections by leading scientists and researchers. So that's, I think, where communities really need and deserve probably better.
Now, in another area of the key findings, it seemed to me you guys had some questions regarding how beneficial these projects might be to the, I guess for lack of a better word, hosts. the odds of benefit are also not often enough seen their way into the list of criteria for decision making.
It's important at this point to have a caveat with our findings is that we didn't follow projects all the way through to their actual impact and the development outcomes that they would have on communities. We looked at how they were designed. And so, you know, I'm not able to talk about how well people have received services or benefits from projects. But the finding that I think you're referring to was pointing out that in some cases, not enough was done to identify who marginalized and vulnerable populations are in a region which would benefit from the project activities. And I think we found roughly two-thirds of the projects did identify these populations, but that still leaves a third of the bank's projects did not.
I think I want to move on to the recommendations portion of your report. I found that the frame of your list of 10 recommendations kind of unique and interesting. There's a total of 10, and they are broken down into 5 points each, half of them made from what appears to be a conceptual approach in terms of when projects are being initiated, and the other half appear to be more about addressing protocol at later operational stages. Can you talk about the challenges that structure provided you and your fellow researchers?
Sure. The way we structured the recommendations, as you point out, is aimed actually at trying to identify which of the steps before a project is approved should be addressed for our recommendation. So in some cases, it has to do with strategic dialogue that the World Bank engages in with countries. And in some cases, it has to do with the methodological approaches that it uses when it puts together the project. And an example of that would be which are the indicators that it'll use to track whether a project has been successful or not. And so we think that's an important area to target our recommendations, because if you have appropriate indicators, in many cases you'll also then be able to track the actual benefits that accrue later on to communities.
Many of the transnational companies listed on your website as corporate partners to the work that you do are considered by many to be part of the problem, especially as it applies to the topics of sustainability and climate change. How often do you find yourselves having to justify or defend those relationships?
I think it's important probably to understand that in trying to solve problems, the organizations such as WI sometimes do have to work with a wide range of stakeholders, and that's one of the things that I think the organization prides itself in. It's its ability to speak with communities on the ground, but also some of these transnational companies, and trying to ensure that we're all working in the same direction. And for some people, that's a challenging thing to accept, but I think it's part of the process.
For folks who want to know more about your report and your organization, is there a website you can direct them to?
Yeah, absolutely. It's WRI.org, so pretty simple and short.
Thank you for taking the time to share your experience and your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking with Malat Patel. He is a research analyst in the area of sustainable finance at the World Resources Institute. For more information, you can visit the website at WRI.org. I'm Robin Ryan, and you're listening to KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin after this newscast, followed by Bread and Roses i6. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we'll have a conversation about U.S. immigration detention centers and how the nonprofit organization Civic is helping to end the isolation of men and women in the system. At 7, it's Heart Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Heart Knock Radio speaks with Mali-born artist Fatoumata Diawara. Tomorrow's weather will be a high of 67 degrees and mostly sunny, with a night low of 42 degrees.
It's 5:26. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One thing about the Tea Party Republicans in Congress is that they do know who butters their biscuits. Several have recently rushed forward with an anguished plea in defense of Wall Street barons, CEOs, and billionaires. Stop the vilification of wealthy people, is their cry. A crusade to protect pampered plutocrats from having to hear the public's scornful words about them is not likely to draw much support from, well, from the public. Still, it is true that being a one percenter is not an easy burden to shoulder. Yes, they do have money and power, but don't you see? They never have enough. If your sense of self-worth is tied up in your net worth, then what if your net is comparatively small? It's important for us riffraff to realize that there are the rich, and then there are the rich. The relativity of status within the 1% creates enormous stress, even feelings of wealth inadequacy. They're constantly thinking, is his bigger than mine? Imagine if you had to live with that. Perhaps you didn't know, but the average household income for the 1% as a whole is a mere $1.26 million a year. Okay, that's rich, but it's not rich. For that honorific, you have to step it up many notches and climb into the elite class of the richest one-tenth of one percenters. Their average household wealth is $6.37 million a year. Now that's money. Yet, it's not enough. Those elites are looked down on by an even thinner slice of net worthies, the royal class of the richest 1/100th of one percenters. This is the stratosphere where the richy richest of the rich dwell, making ends meet on an average household income of $31 million a year. This is Jim Hightower saying, come on, people, have some feeling for the psychic pain of those who are struggling to keep up with the 1/100th of 1%. It's a tough world up there. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. President Obama marked the occasion with a speech at the Lyndon Johnson Presidential Library in Austin, Texas. Obama said that he himself is the endowment of this landmark 1964 law that banned discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, or national origin. But as long as term political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal points out, the U.S. has a long way to go to fully address racial injustice in this country.
New guidelines from the Department of Justice will allow the FBI to continue a controversial program of ethnic mapping. Attorney General Eric Holder's long-awaited revisions to the Justice Department's racial profiling rules was released this week. But civil rights groups say they're disappointed with the content of the revisions. The new rules allow the FBI to continue mapping ethnic populations and using that data to recruit informants and open investigations. A draft of the new rules shows an expansion of the definition of prohibited profiling to include not just race, but religion, national origin, gender, and sexual orientation. The draft increases the standards that agents must meet before considering those factors. But they do not change the way the FBI uses nationality to map neighborhoods, recruit informants, or look for foreign spies. Muslims say federal agents have unfairly singled them out for investigation. Making the FBI blind to nationality would fundamentally change the government's approach to national security. Senator Richard Durbin has said the existing rules are, quote, a license to profile.
Former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was met with opposition Thursday evening during a speech in Las Vegas, Nevada, when a woman in the audience threw a shoe at Clinton in the middle of her speech. The woman who threw the shoe is identified as Allison Michelle Ernest. She walked out of the auditorium with her hands up with the authorities behind her and was later taken into custody and is facing criminal charges.
Cycling about two. What was that, a bat? Was that a bat? Is that somebody throwing something at me? Is that part of Cirque du Soleil? My goodness, I didn't know solid waste management was so controversial.
In 2008, during the last of four trips to Iraq, George W. Bush was also met with a shoe that was thrown at him during a speech. In that incident, it was an Iraqi journalist who threw the shoe while denouncing the former U.S. president as a, quote, dog on TV. Hillary Clinton is expected to run in the presidential election in 2016.
Russia and China have agreed to trade oil and natural gas in their own currencies instead of the U.S. dollar. Russia has also reached an energy deal bypassing the U.S. dollar with Iran and is negotiating a similar deal with India. U.S. Treasury officials have said the deals could violate international laws, and the offending countries face possible trade sanctions. Currently, the U.S. dollar is used for all sales of oil worldwide, even in deals between two foreign countries not involving the United States. This reserve currency, known as the petrodollar, forces countries around the world to save U.S. dollars for buying oil and gas on the world market. This allows the United States to have a large trade deficit without high rates of inflation. If the U.S. dollar was no longer the world reserve currency, foreign goods and imports would be much more expensive than they currently are, decreasing the living standards of Americans. Currently, around 30% of all global currencies are denominated in U.S. dollars, a 50% drop in the last 15 years. The former vice president of the World Bank has recently said he believes the world currency status of U.S. dollar will end within the next 20 years. In a further sign of the declining power of the U.S. dollar, the central banks of over 40 countries worldwide are beginning to hold the Chinese yuan as a reserve currency, a status formerly held exclusively by the U.S. dollar.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Dare, Robin Ryan, Theo Burke, David Lang, and Saconia Wright. Our engineer is Ian Gatberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. I'm Delphine Crescenzo.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Cecil Prescott and Celeste Carey host More Talk Radio. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15 on Locus Focus, Barbara Bernstein speaks with George Bash, founder of the Himalayan Stove Project, which has installed more than 3,000 clean-burning stoves in impoverished homes across Nepal. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Mark about his blood sugar solution 10-day detox diet. It presents strategies for reducing insulin levels and producing fast and sustained weight loss. At 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, Roberta Hall speaks with Jeff Sheminsky. He developed the nonprofit Toxic Awareness Body of Oregon to educate people about the dangerous health effects of many chemicals in everyday use and to publicly advocate for stricter guidelines on applying pesticides and herbicides. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Nelson Mandela said, It always seems impossible until it's done.
And stay tuned now for analysis of this week's top headlines on Counterspin.
Good night, Del.
Good night, Liam.
On Thursday, April 10th, KBOO is hosting a screening of the 1998 electronic music documentary, Modulations. The film starts at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. Following the film, there will be an after-party across the street at Dots with a live set from Audio Electronic and music provided by DJ Tronic. That's Thursday, April 10th, 7 p.m. screening at Modulations at the Clinton Street Theater.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, CBS told viewers the recent presidential election in Afghanistan was a major victory for the U.S. military. In fact, the idea that 12 years of war and occupation have gifted that country with peace and stability is shaping up as the line of the day in U.S. media. We'll speak with Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies for a different take. Also on Counterspin today, we're raising kids all wrong these days. That's what you hear and read all the time, at least. Too many trophies, too much praise, not enough grit. But what if the conventional wisdom about getting tough on kids is all wrong? Alfie Cohn thinks it is. He'll join us to talk about his new book, The Myth of the Spoiled Child. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
It might sound strange to say that sometimes the Israel-Palestine conflict is easy to understand, but the current impasse over peace talks is pretty straightforward. Media coverage